This is a lecture given at St. David's Episcopal Church in Austin, Texas. Visit our website, stdave.org.
Here's the verses I want to read to you from Luke 21. He looked up and saw rich people putting their gifts into the treasury. He also saw a poor widow put in two small copper coins. He said, "Truly I tell you, this..." That's a little ringy. Let me move that down a little bit. This poor widow has put in more than all of them, for all of them have contributed out of their abundance, but she, out of her poverty, has put in all she had to live on. That's a lot in that four little verses. And we'll look at that in a minute. So let me begin with a story. Church I served in Jackson, Mississippi, many years ago, from 1989 to 96, turned 50 years old this past year, 2 years ago. And I went back for the anniversary, and I heard a story I'd never heard. You know, when you're in church, well, you usually hear all the old stories, and I had never heard this one. When the church began, they sent out pledge cards to the whole membership. About 150 people that left another church in town to begin that church, and everybody got pledge cards, about 150 people. No surprise, that's not unusual. Churches do that. But they did this with a twist that I'd never heard. On each card the family received, they received a written estimate of what they thought each member should give in order to make the church a strong reality. Just take that in for a moment, okay?
April, do you hear that?
Yeah. They sent out pledge cards with a number written in, and people were just kind of aghast. So I heard this story from a guy named Kane Ditto. Isn't that a great Southern name? Kane Ditto, K-A-N-E, Kane. He was the chair of deacons, or the senior warden, when I was there. And also, he was the mayor of Jackson, Mississippi when I was there. It seems that when the cards first went out, Kane had just graduated from law school. And as you might imagine, he was up to his ears in debt. He had two little babies. He was absolutely, totally cash poor. But he said this, and I thought this was wonderful. "I was so honored by their confidence in me and what they thought I could do, that I worked extremely hard to rearrange my finances so I could give what they expected. I was so honored by their confidence in me." That's still a bold move. How would you like St. David to send you a card with the amount figured in already? Probably don't want to think about that, Chuck.
Actually, I'm kind of liking this a little.
Yeah. What would be your response if you got a thing from St. David saying, "I think that $4,000 would be a nice gift from you this next year," or $8,000, or $2,000, or $12,000? Would you be outraged by that? Would you start laughing?
Yeah.
Would you be horrified? Would you say, "I think I can do better than that. That's insulting"? Probably not. Or would you say, "I wish I could do that"? Or would you more likely say what a lot of people would say, "Well, you know, giving is private matter between me and God. It's none of their business. They'll find out soon enough." So you heard the widow's mind. Thank God for generous widows, or the church might not make it. I don't know if that's true here, but I suspect it is. I'll tell you a story about that in a minute. Most every church I've served, there's the pen. It didn't fall on the floor. It fell on the... never mind. So many older people on fixed incomes carry a huge portion of the budget responsibility. This do. And maybe that has to do with age and maturity and all that, sir. I'm sure it does. It maybe have to do with a long lifetime of a discipline of giving. I'm sure that's part of it as well. And maybe they have lived long enough that they really understand what it takes for an institution like this to do its ministry and do it well. All those things, I'm sure, come into play. But I suspect that there are some serious widow's mite stories to be told here at St. David's, or that are told, or we could tell ourselves in this room this morning. But as impressed as I am by the widow's behavior, and I'm impressed every time I read this story, I'm equally impressed, if not more so, by the boldness of Jesus. Jesus watched what people gave. You get that? As if we came... Well, I have preached in enough black churches where oftentimes they don't send the plate out. You come to the front and put your money in, or your check, or your envelope, or whatever. And a lot of times, if they don't get what the church needs, they'll do it a second time until we get what we need. And as the white preacher, I'm always taken aback by that. I think there's something lovely about that. And there's something terribly honest about it, but it's still kind of shocking to me. I don't know in the white culture how we would do with that. So Jesus watched what people gave. It wasn't done in secret envelopes. He watched what the people gave. He said the rich and poor. But here's what he goes on and does. Of all things, he commented on it. He commented on it. Really, Doug? That's the best you can do? Picking on Doug's. He commented on it. I mean, you know, we have these wonderful, soft, cuddly pictures of Jesus, and they don't really match up to his lifestyle a lot of times, or his actions. He commented on what people gave. That's all you're giving? I know what your job is as you run the mill in town. You make more money than anybody, and this is what you give. Look at this woman, this widow, who barely gets by. And she's given everything she has right now. Everything. Wow. Doesn't it just get you that Jesus doesn't have any more couth than that? He's just that kind of person. He goes into the temple and he throws over tables. I did a sermon on that text one time. And so in my background reading, I learned about the kind of tables he overthrew. You know what they were? Mostly marble. When he threw over these tables, it was an act of strength that was profound, and an act of anger that was profound. Marble table. Bam! This is the way you treat God's house? How dare you? Heavy marble tables. And then another time he takes more wine and he makes more of it when the wine runs out. What is this about? We've already had wine. Yeah, but you haven't had this wine. And I want you to taste this. And I want you to understand what this wine represents. And so the whole, well, what it says, six flagons were left over. And then he's at a dinner that the Pharisees threw, and a prostitute comes in off the street, and she begins to cry, and she cleans his feet with her tears and her hair. Now, that'll get you thrown out as a pastor. That's not a very astute thing to do, and in fact, it's kind of shocking. What was Jesus saying in doing that act? What was he saying with doing so many of these kinds of actions that were over and above, that were outside the bounds of good taste, that were affrontive, confrontive to you, that were insulting, really. Jesus, who's sweet and gentle and was born in a manger and around sheep and is a nice person, and he's grown up to be, well, somebody that we may have to get rid of. It'd be pretty risky if you had invited John the Baptist over for dinner, wouldn't it? Shows up in a camel's thing. I mean, what kind of shirt is that got on? You know, and you got locust and honey you brought for the dinner. I mean, anybody else have anything besides that? I'm not really looking for locust and honey. Simon Peter's coming over for dinner. Oh my gosh, don't put him next to so-and-so. He's so dadgum arrogant, and he's got a temper just like that. And if he gets into an argument with a Pharisee, you just never tell him what might happen. But listen, by Jesus, he's a perfect gentleman. He's a perfect gentleman. What an unpredictable presence. So when we start talking about money, as sometimes table talk does around dinner, it could get really unsettling if he throws in his 2 cents worth, so to speak. Jesus says out loud, "This poor woman has outgiven all these rich folks." They give out of what? Abundance. They already have plenty. So it's easy to put a few coins in, a few bucks, a few bills, you know. Just go ahead and put $1,000 on a credit card, whatever. And they're all just shocked at what he has to say about that, because she holds nothing back. Now, here's David Letterman's top 10 questions that I've been asked. Question. If a pledge is based on your present income, if my pledge is based upon my present income, and my present income goes down, as mine has since I retired, am I still obligated to give what I pledged? What would you say to that?
This is in the middle of a year, I guess.
Yeah. What would you say?
I'd say no one expects it unless you do.
There you go. And I would go along with that. I would generally say, well, of course not. We'll figure something out. But here's a question I've never received. If my income goes up, should I give more? Should I?
Yep.
Okay. Anybody done that? There you go. All right. Thank you for doing that.
Not all the time.
Not all the time. There you go. Me either. We're not locked into that lower number either. This is between you and God, and more than between you and the financial secretary, okay? Or you and your accountant. Surely, that matters more than God. Jesus said that one day the temple would be destroyed. So it makes no sense to simply make all this giving about institutional support. We are told simply these words, "Give unto the Lord," we are instructed. Give unto the Lord. There's a great clarity that comes with this decision. If when I give, I take that admonition seriously, I am giving to God's work. I'm giving to God's kingdom. This is my way of giving back to God. If that really is what's in our mind when we are deciding what to give, what arises for you? I suspect that's something you've thought about. What arises for you? Yeah.
Well, I always wrestle with how much I should be giving to the church and how much I should be giving directly to people in need.
Okay. We'll talk about that in a minute. All right. Yep, that's a really good question. That's a tough one. Anybody else?
Well, as you get older, you think about what do I need to save for my retirement?
Yeah.
For the unknowns that are ahead.
implications.
For the tax implications, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Or not.
Okay. Second question. Who should fill out a commitment card if you use them here? Do they use commitment cards? Okay. My answer, everyone and anyone who feels led to. But let me add to this. We want our members to, but if a regular visitor feels like this is their church and the ministries of this church reconcile with their values and their understanding of the gospel, then surely giving is one of those values. If husbands and wives or marriage partners give as one, then use one card or whatever the indicator is. But if you give separately, use two. If a child earns an allowance or has a trust fund, as some children might have, teach them how to give accordingly. In fact, as you talk to your children about giving, you might be amazed at the quality of relationship that is built out of that interaction. We did that with both of our children, and in their 30s, I'm proud to say they still give. Or they lie to their dad about it, I don't know. But here was a hard one my daughter asked me. My daughter's much more concerned about money than my son. Dad, they pay you. Why should we give back? And 10% of it, Dad? Or more? And that's our whole income as a family, and we're supposed to give it back? And here was the answer. And I didn't give it. Her brother did. Mary Catherine, listen. Life is a gift. Where did you hear that phrase? Life is a gift. And giving back is a sign of our giving thanks to God. Where did he learn that? I hope he learned it from his parents. But neither one of us had that answer. He did. And that led to a wonderful conversation with our children. We learned that First Baptist Church one time that we only had 4 people under the age of 18 at one time that gave anything. 4. Now we had a lot of kids. A lot of kids. 4 of them gave. Yeah, what do we hear when people talk about giving? What's the first thing? Somebody gives a stewardship testimony. What's the first thing they say?
How much?
How much? Yeah, yeah. What do they say about when they learned about giving? What do they say? I learned to give as a kid, child. I learned to give as a child. So, you know, one of the things that I'm saying in my top 10 list here is work with your children. Work with, for you all, mostly your grandchildren. It's a part of Christian nurture. This leads to a longer conversation of what is stewardship. Being stewards of everything they've been given. They will get into conversation with you about being stewards of the earth. That's a good starting point. They've learned that in school and in their friends and television and everything over and over. And they thank God they have. Because maybe the next generation will help save us. Being good stewards of the earth can also teach you to be good stewards of everything. And that's a great benefit to learn for them and for you to be reminded of. Such an important lesson that helps break the cycle of being so dadgum entitled about everything else that undoes any good. Don't you see children or be around children or teenagers or whatever, who are so entitled to everything. None of you? Okay. Okay. All right. You know, they deserve it. They have to have the best whatever. You know. So how do you take an entitled attitude and transform it into a generous attitude? Boy, that is hard work. And it's not just children who are entitled, is it? No. That's an enormous Christian education challenge for any church to work on. How do we move from entitlement to generosity? What are the steps you take? That is profoundly difficult, and yet it is profoundly important. The very future and life of the church depends on it. Question 3. When we were building our parking garage, following you all off St. David's, and using architects from this church, by the way, which were great, questions always arose. Should we give more to the budget or the garage? This led to a church-wide conversation we had about all our giving opportunities. We had a lot of resistance to the garage when it first came up, and even though they'd been talking about it since 1948. I'm not kidding you. That's the first conversation I had with the pulpit committee. I said, well, what are some of your dreams? Oh, we want a garage and a gym. Really? Well, whose idea was that? Dr. Marnie's. Well, he was here in 1948. Yes. You know, he's dead, you know. Yeah, it would be a great way to honor him. Okay. So I decided that, by golly, we were going to build a parking garage and a gym. Gym's never been built yet because there's no real need for it. But because of the Capitol View corridor, we found out we could only build it 5 stories high. But we also found out along the way that we could save $250,000 by building only 4 stories tall. And so fear gripped us. Fear gripped our congregation. I begged, I pleaded, I did everything I could for us to build that extra floor, knowing how difficult it was going to be when it's in full use to come back and add a 5th floor. And how much more expensive. But fear won the day. And that garage is only 4 stories tall. And here's the joke. 3 weeks after we dedicated that garage, one of our widows died. Paid off the whole garage. And I remember walking back to my office and I thinking, I'll be damned. Yeah. Of course, she would have paid for 5 stories. So here's the other thing about it. The attendance is down some right now. The giving is a struggle. 50% of the income comes from the garage. And that amount keeps going up into the millions of dollars. And the business manager, one of my best friends, laments constantly about the 5th floor until I say, please, let's not talk about that anymore. He always says, you know, we saved $250,000 and lost several million more. But now there is a conversation about adding on the 5th floor and the projection cost. Well. When we had that all-important conversation several Sundays and Wednesdays, we came up with 4 key areas: the ministry budget, the external missions, the statewide needs with Texas Baptist Partners, which you don't have, and the underfunded areas in the city of Austin. Those are the 4 things we decided we needed to budget for. Within those 4 areas, we found room for all kinds of people to give. The millennials in our congregation tended not to give to general ministry funds. They just didn't. But one year, we decided to build some wells in Uganda because we'd had one of our church members spend some time there. Came back and talked about it. Decided to build some wells. 2 wells were going to cost us $25,000, 2 wells. And some people said, well, we ought to do a little more. Now, it was me this time. I didn't think we could do that. It was going to be Christmas. People, you know, it was tight and money was tight. And who would do that, you know? And the first Sunday that we were going to give, a 27-year-old millennial who designs video games put in a check for $60,000. Video games. Holy mackerel. We hope to build 2. We end up building 12. The money, he tapped that. And other millennials started giving and other people. And pretty soon, it's like, okay, that's, you know, we got to save some money for other things. You know? This is wonderful. This was wonderful. This was a God thing. And then we finally did something that they had talked about for longer than 1948. You know, we ought to start a foundation. Yeah, that'd be a great thing to start a foundation. I bet St. David's has a foundation. Oh, they have a foundation. I bet First Methodist has. Oh, yeah, First Methodist has a foundation. I bet St. Martin's. Yeah, St. Martin's has a foundation. I bet Central Press. Yeah, Central Press has a foundation. You know, we're all the only bunch of God's people downtown that don't have a foundation. And so we started a foundation. Because here's what was happening. People would die. Can you believe this? People would die. And they would leave very generous gifts, but they would tie our hands with their designations. This is going to go to Southern Baptist missions in China. Well, Lottie Moon's been dead a long time now. You all don't know who that is, but Chuck does. And so we said, we came up with this foundation, and we built a lot of flexibility into that foundation, and we started teaching about the foundation. And now they don't get those death gifts that tie the hands, because at one time there was something like $600,000 just sitting there that we couldn't touch because it was all tied up with, you know what, whatever. And we finally talked to enough of their remaining family members, and we had lawyers involved, and we had long conversations, and they even transferred most of that money into the foundation, gave it a lot more freedom. And so the ministry of the church expanded so much, not so much for local stuff, but for stuff really all around the globe. And it was a cause for real celebration.
Roger.
Yeah.
This is not as applicable today as it was at one time, but Jim Bethel and I used to just wring our hands when one of our pillars of the church, women, died, and they left everything to UT.
No.
I'm a UT person, but that was terrible because we knew that if we had been talking to them regularly, about giving it to St. David's, that's probably where the money would have gone.
Yeah.
So you have to have an ongoing process in reminding people before they take. Most of those were houses. They didn't realize what kind of value they had in their houses.
Yeah. Well, I've had that story happen over and over again.
Just in case you're wondering, we can deal with your real estate issues.
Yeah. Absolutely. But We had as many that went to Baylor as went to UT, but a lot of UT. Yeah. Yeah, that good old Baylor line just kept pulling in the money, you know. In fact, I'll never forget one time. Oh, I got to be careful because I don't want to reveal any identities. But somebody who was a very large giver and very successful died and left the church $10,000. That was fantastic. And he left $4 million to Baylor. And he left another couple of million that helped build the new football stadium. That was over and above. He left $10,000 to First Baptist Church, even though he hadn't missed a Sunday in 50 years. I wanted to weep. I mean, not just for the loss of money, but for the loss of understanding. Where had we failed? One other thing that's important to talk about is just what you just said. I didn't realize that was in my notes next. Is to talk about needs, you know, so that those kind of things happen. We had a First Baptist, I keep scooting back on this thing.
Don't scoot too far.
Yeah, I won't scoot too far, I know it. First Baptist was given a nice gift, and we replaced the roof and redid the chapel, which was pretty dingy looking, and did some other things. We built the theater that's on the fourth floor, which is a wonderful theater. They do wonderful plays if you haven't been over there, and it's free. We have best actors in Austin work in that theater. But we had this parlor that was just, oh. And it was right there when you walked in. Do you understand what I mean when I say something is puke yellow? That was the color. And it had this old fireplace with a brass hood. So it was like 1950s, just exactly. And the chairs were just awful. And the couches, you could see inside of them. And, you didn't dig around between the cushions to find a quarter. You went into the cushions to get it. So I did a funeral one day. And I always, people always went to the parlor before service, the family, and I'd go in there and have a prayer with them, and then we would lead in. And so we're walking to the back of the sanctuary, and a member of the family, and I didn't know him at all, but he was a really tall guy, and he just looked down at me as we were walking. He goes, "Pastor," I said, "Yes, sir." "I don't mean to offend anything." I said, "Yeah, what?" He said, "That parlor's the ugliest thing I've ever seen." I said, "Yeah, it really is." I said, "We just haven't put the money aside, you know. I kind of know what it would be." And he said, "What would it cost?" I said, "I don't know, maybe $25,000, just new furniture." "Well, I don't know, you know." Didn't say anything. Went in the funeral. A month later, my business manager came down and knocked on the door and opened the door. He said, "Guess what?" And I said, "What?" "Open this envelope." Opened it up, and there was a check for $50,000. And it arrived from a law firm where this man was one of the chief partners. And it said, "Please redo that god-awful parlor." It's really nice now. Talking about needs is important. It really is. This is a gift that you give the church when you talk about what we need. It doesn't have to be all the time, but it does be more than you think. We need to talk about that specifically. We could be doing X, Y, and Z if we had the funds for this. We need to dream bigger about things. We need more generosity. Just talking about that. How much should I give to what? Question comes up. Specific amounts are not a way to answer this. $10,000 is too little for some people. $100 is too much for others. You've heard this forever, but it's true, I believe. Have a long-term plan. Pick a percentage. Start there. Work towards a tithe. Start even when you have a little. Well, we've all heard that. I'll say it again. Pick a percentage, start there, work towards a tithe, and start even when you have a little. 1% becomes 2%, becomes 3%, becomes 4%, becomes 5%, becomes 6%, becomes 10%, becomes maybe more. It never gets easy, but it's so much easier with a plan. I had opportunity on some occasions to know William Sloan Coffin fairly well. And he was pastor of Riverside Church. And he told me a story about John D. Rockefeller, who tithed apparently his entire life. Coffin said that Riverside owned a recording of Rockefeller saying that people, in which they, like an old wire recording, whatever. And Rockefeller is speaking to the church. And he said, people think it's easy when you have all the money I have to give. He said, well, I one time didn't have all this money. Now, I kind of doubt that. But he said, here's the thing. When I didn't have that much money, it was hard to give. It was really hard to give. But when I had enormous sums, it was hard to give. It was really hard to give. And he said then, but it was enormously rewarding. This church, meaning Riverside, brings me tears every time I walk into it. God gave me a vision, he said. That's all he said. Coffin says. You know, even a church like Riverside has trouble. I used to get their newsletter, and I remember one year when the endowment contributed $6 million to their budget, and the entire rest of the congregation contributed $827. And you know why? Because they'd gotten so used to Rockefeller's money that they quit giving. So there's a danger in some of that. Everybody needs to be a part of it. Question 5, and you may think it's ridiculous, but what is a tithe and why is it an issue? And I'll just say some general things. A tithe obviously means 1/10 of your income. It started back in the Old Testament when God told Moses to distribute the land to the 12 tribes of Israel. What time does this end?
I've got about 10 minutes.
Okay. His brother Aaron was leader of the Levites, the priestly clan. That clan was given no land, but God ordered that everyone should give them a little to keep them going, doing ministry and not being preoccupied with income. They tended the temple, the spiritual life of the people. They took care of the poor. That was their calling, and that's part of where the tithe came from. Later, the prophet Malachi chided Israel for neglecting to tithe, saying that they were robbing God. I never found any place in Scripture where that was renegotiated. What does a tithe look like? If you gave $2,000 a year, that would mean your income is $20,000 a year. Given that the average pledge at First Baptist Church had been and continues to be about $3,500, my guess is we don't have many tithers, or it must be a very poor congregation. The garage tells me different. Know what I'm saying? I decided that by focusing on being a welcoming and affirming, grace-oriented church, we had become so afraid to offend people that we never talked about it. So one thing I decided I could do was to focus on stewardship in sermons at all kinds of times during the year and not during the fall campaign. Surprise, another stewardship sermon. Just a reminder. This isn't just about money. This is about our discipline as people of faith. This is how we grow as individuals in our spiritual lives. And it makes a great difference to the church and to the ministry we're trying to do. And we need to talk about this often. And so I did. And I learned that, you know what? By not doing it in the fall, they were so happy to hear it at the other times that it began to change how we gave. And it grew a little bit. Number 6. But isn't 10% an Old Testament law? And didn't Jesus bring grace instead of rules? My answer is, Jesus said he did not come to abolish that law. He said he came to show its meaning and to learn how to live from it rather than be punished by it. If we say we shouldn't be slaves to a tithe, that's fine, as long as we want to learn how to grow and live generously rather than beneath it. Jesus taught that everything belongs to God. We, the stewards, are the stewards of that and maybe need to be asking how much we really need to live on rather than how much we need to give on. Yeah.
So I've always thought about tithing to include three things: time, talent, and treasure.
Yep.
And I guess I focused a lot on time and talent, but I couldn't afford the treasure.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I guess that's still valid.
It's still valid, and I intentionally did focus on the other two because I want to talk about giving. But yeah, I mean, and those are the things that you focus on most of the time of the year. And so because money is a little difficult to talk about. No, it's not. It's a lot difficult to talk about. We don't talk about it much. And here's a question that always came up: should I tithe on the gross or net? My reply was always this. Next question. Number 8. Well, shouldn't wealthy people bear the burden of giving? I had lots of people who could barely stay afloat and need all the extra money they can scrape to get together. I had folks who were terribly underemployed, and it was hard to look them in the face as I talked about giving, to be honest with you. But that's why the story of the widow became very important. Jesus didn't seem to think this widow was wrong in giving her 2 coins to the temple. That's hard, but she became a model because of her attitude. She gave out a sacrifice, which is the real call. Sacrifice is the real call. Generous sacrifice is the better phrase. Generous sacrifice. It might not mean that much money. It might mean a lot of money. But that's part of being a community of faith. The priesthood of the believer, every believer, is a foundational Protestant principle. We are all priests of God, not just Chuck. Not just the people who wear collars around their neck. Especially in this heat. So if generous sacrifice is all of our call, then we as a community always, always have some serious work yet to do. It's a part of our growing as disciples. I hope that I'm still growing as a disciple when I'm in my last days. And that might be today. I did a funeral yesterday. Went back to First Baptist to a funeral of a woman who died of a brain tumor, 55 years old. She's been a great friend of me. She kept a journal and she asked me to read it at the funeral. Some of it was really tough. Some of it I didn't read. But she talked about the abuse that she had all of her life from her father and her mother. Emotional, physical, sexual, all kinds of abuse. And how she quit believing in God because she saw nothing good. But she married a guy named Dan Stakely. Some of you might know Dan. He played football at Texas some years ago. Dan had come out of a crushing divorce and they met. And Dan had grown up in a totally different kind of home. And his influence on Patty became absolutely profound. And she became one of the most loving, generous, happy, joyous, sacrificing, stalwart people you'd ever want to know. I had no idea about all this terrible pain in her life until she was near the end. When she had gotten the brain tumor and things weren't going well, she called me to her house one day and she said, "I have a story to tell you." And she took time with me and told me that story. And it was Dan and it was the community of faith around her, she says, that taught her to be generous, that taught her to be kind, that taught her that there is nothing more important than love. She died with so much at peace. And she left a nice gift for the church, which is irrelevant. But she mostly left this spirit that will live on a long time. We build our giving out of community. And this is a wonderful community. I've known that for a long time. You are the heartbeat of this community. Talking to people about giving. Talking about what you gain from it. Talking about things the church could be doing. That's your job. That's the gift you get out of this. You become ambassadors for St. David's and for the kingdom. Somebody asked a question that I'm going to get to. Should I give all my giving go to the church, or can I split it up with other charitable giving? The principle from Malachi is you give your tithe tied to the storehouse, and that was a temple in those days, and maybe that's the church in these days, I'm not sure. In fairness, they didn't have social agencies or parachurch ministries or all the things we have today. I don't quibble about that. But I think we ought to start with giving close consideration to the body of Christ to which we belong. Now, that's interesting to me to say because I'm a minister and I'm employed by the church. Okay, I'd say that. The body that nurtures faith in us and our family and that has needs that only its members can meet. No other group is giving money to the church except you all. We really don't receive funds from any other source. But I think we start here and you work it through with God. And then after that, you support other groups that you believe are doing good work. Whether it's kingdom work or not, I'll let you debate on that. But if it's something, some kind of work that's life-saving work, is what I say. If you're saving some people's lives, you're giving some battered women a chance to breathe deeply for once in their life and not live in fear. If you're giving some kids in East Austin some decent clothes to wear, if you're doing some of those things, you can do them through the church if you want, or you can do them outside the church, it doesn't matter. That's kingdom work. And you feel good about it and you be generous in it. That's my feeling. Am I wrong about that?
No.
One last thing. How often should I give? You can give. If you can, give in a systematic way. Some can't do that, but some can. Maybe the best way is to give as often as you get paid or as often as you pay bills. Some people need to give once a year so they know what their tax obligations are going to be. But honestly, the more regularly you give, the better it is for you and the better it is for the church. And I always hope that my giving was larger than my tax bill. You know what I'm saying? At the end of the year, if I owe the IRS, if I'm giving them, writing a bigger check to them than I've written to the church that year, then I need to think about that. I know there's all kinds of quibbles in that and stuff. But I'm just saying, for me. And there have been times when I've had to write Uncle Sam a bigger check than I did down here. And I'm not real proud of that. But there are other times when I was able to be more generous. And I wasn't able to because I had more money, but I was able to because I had more spirit. And then this morning, two of your staff members walked in. They said, please say something about staff. Okay, staff. Yeah. Thank you all very much. Enjoyed this.
You can find more lectures and sermons on iTunes by searching for St. David's Episcopal Church in Austin, Texas, or visit our website at saintdave.org and click on the podcast button.